Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live December 11, 2005 from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois on a very wintry December Sunday afternoon. Today we have a live show for you with a wonderful guest, a guest who has tremendous experience in the field of journalism and journalism monitoring, here to talk about the most important issues of the day, how they're covered, how they're not covered, and what can be done. Our guest will be Sam Hunsaney. Please join us, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The city of New Orleans plans to build a citywide wireless broadband network. Unlike other cities that have jumped on the Wi-Fi bandwagon, though, New Orleans plans to make access to the network absolutely free. City officials believe ubiquitous broadband access will entice people back to the still ravaged city and speed its rebuilding and recovery process. There's just one problem. A state law prohibits local governments from offering public broadband access. But because New Orleans still resides under a declaration of a state of emergency, it can ignore that law for now. What happens when the emergency is over, though, is another story. City officials plan to seek a waiver for their network, or they may lobby to overturn the state law completely. The plan's already drawn retaliation from New Orleans' incumbent phone company, Bell South. The company had offered to donate a building in New Orleans to the city for use as a replacement police headquarters, but hours after the mayor and other city officials announced the free wireless project, Bell South officials reneged on their donation. While the company disputes this characterization, it is not the first time Bell South's been caught trying to strong-arm a municipality out of offering broadband service to its citizens. Last year, when the city of Lafayette, Louisiana, announced plans to build a municipal fiber-optic data network, which would be open to the public, Bell South threatened to close a customer service call center in Lafayette, which would have meant the loss of 1,300 jobs. The citizens of Lafayette voted to move ahead with the fiber network anyway, and the call center remains open.
More shadiness to report at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, where the corporation's board of directors is asking an outside auditor to revise a report which hints at fiscal mismanagement among present and former top CPB executives. The primary controversy involves a compensation package given to former CPB President Robert Conrud. He stepped down from the post last year, but before he left, the board awarded him a $500,000 consulting contract, with payments structured in such a way as to get around statutory limits on CPB executive salaries. His successor lasted less than a year, but she's been promised a $400,000 severance, which is also specially structured to get around tax reporting requirements. What's worse, all these deals were done while current CPB board chair Cheryl Halpern oversaw the agency's audit committee. So why has the board asked PricewaterhouseCoopers to rewrite its work? The official claims allege factual inaccuracies in the report, but the likely truth is a desire to water down the more politically explosive findings. Meanwhile, former CPB Chairman Kenneth Tomlinson's crowning achievement, a conservative-leaning public affairs program featuring editors from The Wall Street Journal, retired from the PBS lineup on December 2nd. The show is not over, though. The Fox News Channel will air the Journal editorial report instead, although it has not yet determined its time slot.
New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer scores another major coup in his ongoing investigation into payola deals between record labels and radio stations. The Warner Music Group settled with Spitzer last month for just over $5 million. It also admitted that some of its promotional practices were, quote, wrong and improper and reflected widespread industry behavior. Evidence collected shows how Warner label reps doled out getaway trips and electronics to radio stations in exchange for airplay for their artists. It's the second settlement for Spitzer's investigation. In July, the Sony BMG conglomerate settled for $10 million but refused to admit any wrongdoing, and many of the executives implicated in that investigation remain at their jobs today. Now, Congress is getting involved in the payola controversy. Senator Russ Feingold has introduced legislation that would increase the FCC's enforcement authority in payola cases. The Wisconsin Democrats' bill would also require radio stations to make their playlists public and list all compensation, monetary or otherwise, they receive from music industry sources. And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact. Product placement is already pervasive on television, and now it's making great strides into the world of print. According to industry analysts, when the year is finished, some $161 million worth of product placements will have found their way into magazines, while product placements in newspapers are expected to top $65 million. Not only do most newspapers and magazines fail to disclose when they use product placements, but they also won't say under what circumstances they're paid for them. From the reader's perspective, 65% already believe product placements in print are a common occurrence. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, December 11th, 2005, from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, here on lovely WILL-AM 580. We have a wonderful guest today. Sam Husseini is joining us for the hour, and I hope you'll all try to call in and get questions in if you wish. Sam Husseini is the Communications Director for the Institute for Public Accuracy, which is based in Washington, D.C. His office is in the National Press Building. Sam Husseini has written articles that have appeared on politics and foreign affairs and media coverage in a number of issues, pop culture, in the Washington Post, Newsday, the Chicago Tribune, The Nation, The Humanist, on and on and on. Before joining the Institute for Public Accuracy, Sam Husseini was media director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. And before turning to Sam Husseini, I have to acknowledge that I am on the board of the Institute for Public Accuracy and have been, I think, since its inception, although I've never received any compensation for it, but let that be out in the open. In fact, I don't know, Sam Husseini, you work for them. Have you received much compensation from them?
I have to admit to having received a fair amount of compensation.
Well, well-deserved.
Not excessive, I should say.
Yeah, that point I can underline, being on the board, not excessive at all. Sam, welcome to Media Matters Today.
Good to be with you, Bob.
Why don't you tell folks a little bit about the Institute for Public Accuracy, why it was founded, and what it does and what you do there?
We try to put out news releases, timely information featuring facts, experts, analysts, activists, with brief, to-the-point information and get it out to a plethora of media in a timely basis, hopefully on the news cycle of something happening, whatever that is. We're very much a multi-issue group, and we try to put out information, whether it's an environmental conference happening in Montreal or Bush making a statement about didn't lie about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction or anything else. And we try to we're a very small group, but we're networked into a very wide range of analysts, activists, writers, academics, and so on, and we try to get that information out in a very timely fashion. And people can look at our webpage to see the range of what we've done, accuracy.org. And we also try to abide by what I like to call a standard of ethical communication. That is, we put up a news release on our webpage, and we don't change it, we don't take it down from the day that it's put up. So people actually, there's actually a historical record. I think a lot of media outlets and perhaps even nonprofits would rather, either tuck away or put aside some pieces of information that they've disseminated. We don't do that. We leave everything up.
Sam Husseini, why was IPA established, the Institute for Public Accuracy? What need does it hope to fill?
Well, it actually originated with our founder, Norman Solomon. writing an article on the Heritage Foundation in the mid-1990s for Extra, the Journal of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, which noted that the amazing success that the Heritage Foundation had had in disseminating their point of view on a wide variety of issues, whether it's savings and loan issues, economic issues, some foreign policy issues, welfare reform, so-called welfare reform, and so on, and the amazing impact that they had had over time.
And how did they have this impact?
Well, they have a very substantial media machine. They have a rather hefty building here in Washington, D.C. They're very much plugged into Republican lawmakers. They're very much plugged into the media. They have a battery that works with and gets information out to both mainstream media as well as right-wing talk radio to push their agenda in a very... they're a large organization, but it's still remarkably effective from all we can see. And there was... I mean, there are some nonprofit, obviously some nonprofits, some think tanks in Washington, D.C. doing some work, and we had wanted to add to both scrutinizing them explicitly as well as scrutinizing a broader agenda in terms of disinformation that's put out and trying to challenge it in a real-time basis on the news cycle and trying to be very nimble about it.
To be a little less abstract here, I mean, Norman Solomon was not did not think the Heritage Foundation was necessarily making a wonderful contribution to our political culture. Is that a safe statement?
That's a fair statement. Oh,
and why would that be, and what exactly would how would IPA... you know, counterbalance that or alter it?
Well, I mean, in terms of getting experts out and scrutinizing the facts of what they propagate, say, you know, welfare reform. They had a substantial amount of success around that in the mid-1990s, and there was certainly some back and forth on that, but they pretty much dominated the debate.
And by dominating it, I mean, just to get clear, because I think our listeners are probably unfamiliar with this how this works, Sam. By dominating, it means that they would have their experts be available to journalists covering it, so their particular viewpoint and the viewpoint of their experts would tend to be entered into most of the coverage and shape a lot of it, and other viewpoints would tend to fall by the wayside. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
I think that's a fair way to characterize it. Not only would they be turned to as experts, but as you note, that they would frame it, that they're concerns or alleged concerns would be what, how the packaging is done. What the core issue, what the alleged problem that you know is there to solve, is what frames the story.
And then what IPA tries to do is offer alternative experts than the ones that Heritage and the sort of standard Rolodex would offer, working journalists covering a story.
Occasionally, we try to scrutinize their role in things. For example, right now coming up is the whole Medicare question and the pharmaceutical plans that people are choosing from, or people who are Medicare are choosing from. And this is a significant accomplishment, again, by the Heritage Foundation in this case. Of them framing issues in a way that was very beneficial to large pharmaceutical companies, which account for some portion of their contributions to making the Heritage Foundation work. So they have framed the issue in a way that ends up being very beneficial to their substantial portion of their corporate patrons. They've pushed legislation through, and they framed the issue in the media in that fashion.
We're talking to Sam Husseini today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Sam Husseini is the Communications Director for the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's based in the National Press Building in Washington, a journalist, a critic. Sam Husseini has been working this turf for a good decade, at least that I've known you, Sam, I think that long. Before working at IPA, Sam Husseini was the Media Director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. If you have a question or comment for Sam Husseini to talk about the work of IPA, the work he's been doing, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. If you go online to the Institute for Public Accuracy website, which is simply accuracy.org, you will see the broad range of issues that the IPA covers that Sam Husseini is working on. And let's just jump into some of these issues that are hot now so our listeners get a chance to see what sort of work you're doing, Sam, and what the key issues as you see it are. What are the current projects that the IPA is working on?
Over the last week, we did a fair amount of work on the Christian Peacemaker team being held in Iraq and trying to get different voices out there on that, which is rather novel. We tried to get voices from the Middle East. We try to globalize things as much as possible.
How well has this story been covered, and how has it been covered? And what is the story? Because I think some of our listeners might not even be familiar with this.
Indeed, and I should have given some background. I mean, the Christian Peacemaker team is incredibly... It's sort of a good juxtaposition for the rhetoric that, you know, the media cover things that are novel. Media love man bites dog stories and so on. Christian Peacemaker team is a very novel story. It's a group of activists who went to Iraq shortly before the invasion of Iraq. They stuck around even after most folks quit, and they actually had documented the abuses going on in the U.S.-run prisons in Iraq before Cy Hirsch was leaked pictures at Abu Ghraib. They fundamentally had the story by doing a novel thing. They actually listened to Iraqis and wrote down their testimony and, you know, took it somewhat seriously. And they were largely ignored. I'll be frank, I didn't know about...
These are Americans mostly?
These are mostly Americans, some Brits, some Canadians. But they're all Westerners. So when the Abu Ghraib story broke, I found out about their work, and we publicized them to substantial results. Finally, their work was, you know, supplementing the pictures that Cy Hirsch got and putting flesh on that story. Well, they've continued to toil away in Iraq and largely outside of the green zone, this sort of restricted area that most U.S. journalists, virtually all U.S. journalists, stay in, and therefore you get a very narrow picture of what's going on in Iraq. These people actually get out there and actually talk to ordinary Iraqis about their concerns and so on. Unfortunately, some group calling itself the Swords of Righteousness kidnapped them, I think about a week and a half ago now, and a bunch of people put together a petition trying to get them released. And what I thought was interesting was a lot of statements were coming out from the Middle East, even from, you know, the most incredibly extreme organizations. Hamas signed a statement calling for their release. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade signed a statement calling for their release. You'd sort of think that this would have some novel news value if the, you know, typical rhetoric of we want novel stories is to be believed. So we've done some work on that and trying to get that sort of bridge in terms of a dialogue, however tenuous that might be.
Has there been much coverage of the story so far?
I wouldn't say that there's been a tremendous amount of coverage. I suspect that if they're killed, there'll suddenly be a tremendous amount of coverage. I hope we won't find out whether that guess is true or not.
Yeah, that'd be a dreadful story. We're talking to Sam Husseini today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show here in WILL AM 580, so please do call in if you have questions, 333-9455. And our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Sam Husseini, Communications Director for the Institute for Public Accuracy, which does a lot of work trying to introduce alternative perspectives on the big news stories of the day to put voices in and experts in who aren't normally on the Rolodex of working journalists. You can learn more about the Institute for Public Accuracy at accuracy.org on the web. And Sam Husseini has his own website for those who want to hear his own writings, just at husseini.org, H-U-S-S-E-I-N-I.org. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Spring Bay, you're on the air with Sam Husseini.
Oh, good afternoon. I was calling to see if Mr. Husseini knew who the largest contributors were to the Heritage Foundation.
I haven't looked at it in a while, but what was startling, the big financial houses, I think, largely because they were pushing Social Security privatization, had pumped a lot of money into Heritage over the last 5 years. But what was surprising when looking at something like Heritage and where they do raise their money was they get a lot of money from people who share their agenda. They get a lot of $250, $500 checks from, you know, I guess what would best be described as Republican Party activists.
Yeah, not like major rich million-dollar funders, in other words.
I mean, they do have that.
Yeah.
I haven't looked at this in a couple of years, but I remember being startled by how much of it was just this, you know, several thousand checks from ordinary, well, not ordinary, but, you know, presumably upper middle class Republican activists.
And to be fair and balanced, who are your contributors for your organization?
We mostly get our funding from foundations. We do get occasional high donors, individuals. We get some money from individuals, but it's not a great deal.
Yes, Sam, you're not on the board of directors, and I don't think. And
no, I'm not.
You know, and you don't see the books. But I mean, what is the ratio of money that goes to groups like Heritage, Cato, and American Enterprise Institute that are working to push news coverage in their direction to a group like yours and whatever allies you might have on your side? If you could,
I would be thrilled to have 1% of Heritage's budget. I think it's just overwhelmingly.
Where could a person go to find out who the contributors to these various think tanks are?
They are obligated to disperse that type of information either through their annual reports or their what's the financial statement, Bob?
The
90 or
something? Yeah, the Wall Street the SEC forum.
Yeah. I don't think they're a nonprofit organization.
Nonprofit firm. They're tax firm. But you know, my producer Andrew Boyle just emailed me or IM'd me to be hip. If you go to their website, heritage.org, you can learn something about our operation.
Well, we always hear so many spokespeople from these various think tanks, and I just wish that when journalists would have, and I'm not talking about you, Bob, necessarily, this is just a general comment, I would wish that people would start to say, and their contributors are, or this is where they get their funding, because I just have the feeling that a lot of these think tanks are fronts for people that have some specific agenda or point of view, and I'd like to know who's funding that free speech. I'll hang up and listen to your program.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, Sam, do you want to follow up on that?
Yeah, I think that would sort of reminded of Jim Hightower's remark of, you know, politicians ought to have corporate logos on them like NASCAR racers. I think the same could probably be said for a lot of these, a lot of folks like Heritage, American Enterprise Institute, Cato. They break down in peculiar ways. For example, Cato is ostensibly libertarian, but they sort of mumble their libertarianness in some circumstances and really shout about it. When it comes to other issues like Social Security privatization, they're suddenly very outspoken. They do some good work in terms of corporate welfare, for example, but it's pretty much sidelined because that's not where the money is, because they can get a lot more money by pushing Social Security privatization.
Well, why doesn't a group like IPA, and there are other groups other than the Institute for Public Accuracy that are trying to provide a perspective on the news or resources for journalists, that aren't coming from sort of the corporate world, but the non-corporate world on
right.
behalf of other constituencies. Why aren't you getting the sort of money, I mean, that these other groups are getting? And not just, and here I don't mean simply IPA, but I mean other groups that might be doing related type work.
Getting what kind of money?
The kind of money Heritage is getting. The amounts, not from the same people. But why is there this resource imbalance?
I think that there's perhaps an overemphasis on giving money to electoral causes rather than structural things like media nonprofits or, for mm-hmm. that matter, independent media.
Among liberals and progressives and
that's
that crowd. Yeah.
That's my sense. Or, there are some liberal, I guess you call them liberal think tanks that are well-funded. I'm sure that the Center for American Progress is fairly well-funded, which is headed by John Podesta. He used to be in the Clinton administration.
And an Illinois native, you'll be glad to know.
Sorry?
And an Illinois native.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. It's not as much of an imbalance as one might think if one doesn't look at the sort of centrist groups, liberal centrist groups that are out there. But I think it's a matter of, I've grown to be, it's astonishing being in Washington, Bob, and seeing the opportunities that are here and the complacency that's here. I think that a few, really sharp either independent media outlets or IPA-like things could be getting into news conferences, could be doing a lot of things that would really challenge the news cycle in very creative ways.
So you're saying, do journalists respond well generally, do you say? Do people hang up the phone when you call or turn off the fax machine when you send a fax or
no,
an email?
No, they don't. I think they generally want to see our stuff. Whether they act on it or not is a different story, and it varies. For example, during the build-up to the Iraq invasion, we were getting some media play, not a ton, but some, and not always in the ways that we would have wanted. As soon as the, shock and awe campaign started, it just shut down totally, mm-hmm. and nothing was getting picked up, except for international stuff. We get picked up by, CBC and BBC and other foreign media, fairly regularly. And that's sort of a good, it's a good gauge for us to know that we're being reasonably effective. We are being shut out, for political reasons. We're not, it's a gauge for us as to mm-hmm. whether or not it's the effective, the quality of our work.
Or how sensitive an issue is, too.
Well, most definitely. But we, frankly, tend to try to go for the most sensitive of issues.
Yeah, as I'm knowing, going through the roster and people who go to the IPA website at xc.org, you're going after the biggest issues, not the trivial ones, the ones that are right at the center of the news cycle.
Right.
Our guest again, Sam Husseini, today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. It's a live show here on WILL AM 580. Sam Husseini, Communications Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, working out of the National Press Building in Washington, trying to help journalism have a somewhat more rounded coverage of stories and not rely as much on official sources or on right-wing corporate-funded think tanks. Sam Husseini you can ask him a question if you wish by calling this number, 333-9455, or the toll-free number, and the line is open, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone line right now. Line 1 on the cell phone, you're with Sam Husseini, and thank you for your patience.
What, is that me?
That is you, sir.
Oh, okay. I want to kind of change it up a little bit. I've been real curious since this war has started over there. Is there some obstacle to the age-old thing about following the money? It's my impression that Iraq is the number 2 pile of oil in the world and that the big oil companies have gotten what they want with the young Bush guy in there, and they've gone over and taken control of the oil fields. Why isn't there any media coverage or any investigation into that? Because to me, that seems to be the one reason why we're still over there.
I'm really glad you...
Apparently, they haven't found anybody in the Iraqi government, quote-unquote, if there is a government, that will play ball with the oil people. So that's That's kind of my viewpoint on it, and I'm just curious on why that hasn't become a story at all, and that the shift of the story, which I gather your organization is does a lot of work to make sure that doesn't happen, but is falling into the trap that all of the media is focused on the righteousness of the war. Well, I'm a little bit more curious about the money.
Well, thank you very much, caller.
Is that it? Okay.
I'll
listen to what you got to say.
Thank you. It's Sam, I think this might be a good opportunity for you to also give sort of a broader view of the coverage of the Iraq war and then go specifically at the question of oil and money.
Sure. Let me try to do both. I mean, the caller talked about the righteousness of the war, and we've done a fair amount of work questioning that I can't say every turn. But, I mean, what's fundamentally happened with the justifications for war was the WMD justification was the primary one before the war. And I should say, because I think that there has been, even among so-called critics of Bush, a good amount of disinformation about this. It's not the case that we knew that Bush lied after the war when we found out that there were no weapons of mass destruction to be found. We knew that he was lying before the war, and we said so. We put out news releases talking about a pattern of deceit before the invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, because you could tell that Bush was lying. He would talk about an IAEA report saying that Iraq was close to a nuclear weapon, and then you turn to the IAEA, and they would say there's no such report. So we knew that he was lying before the war. And I think that a lot of people who position themselves as critics of Bush have, in effect, enabled Bush by obscuring that fact. And then we've since then gotten into the rationale about bringing democracy, although it was mentioned a little bit before the war, but that's become the primary rationale, and we've scrutinized that substantially as well. The question of oil, I think, is central, and it's going to become very crucial right now because they haven't, in fact, really grabbed the oil fields yet, because what they need to do that, by that they, I mean the Bush administration and the major Anglo-American oil companies, is a quote-unquote sovereign government. And they are hoping that these elections, just coming up on this coming week, will provide them with that so that they can get a compliant but quote-unquote independent sovereign government to sign off on these long-term oil contracts. There's a British group called Platform, which did an extensive study on this about 2 weeks ago. We immediately put out a news release on their study, which was incredibly thorough. It's on our webpage. It was about 2 weeks ago. We linked to their study from our webpage, and it was called Crude Designs, detailing what the plans were for Iraqi oil and how they were pretending not to privatize Iraq's oil, but in effect finding so many legal get-arounds that the net effect is a mass privatization of the oil, which, as the caller noted, is the second largest proven oil reserves in the world. And not only is it the second largest proven oil reserve, but it's incredibly cheap to pump out. That is, a barrel of Iraqi crude only costs about $1 to get out of the ground. Venezuela, for example, it costs about $11 to get a barrel of crude.
Because that's out in the ocean, is that right? Or out in the sea?
It's just the nature, it's the quality of the oil, it's the nature of, at what, for geological reasons that I don't fully understand.
No, I would. Well, although I should point out, you were once an engineer, right? You went to Carnegie Mellon?
I went to Carnegie Mellon. I was a computer scientist.
Computer scientist. Okay, that makes you science-y enough for us.
So that I can
You can fool us, yeah.
But
it's funny, before the war, to mention the idea that oil had something to do with the U.S. invasion of Iraq put you sort of in the sort of lunatic fringe of UFO conspiracy theorists.
Sort of, but there was this constant dual notion. There was a front page story in the Washington Post before the war, mm-hmm, about, all the oil companies, looking at this. And that was it. They'll throw out this one story, and then at all other times, It's this far-fetched, crazy notion, and it's just amazing how the media functions in that way.
Well, as all the other explanations for the war are sort of fallen over, like, you know, boxers knocked out. I guess this is the last one standing.
Yeah, and I think that it's important to look at it that way. I don't know how useful it is, and I think a lot of us fall into the trap of just saying Bush is an idiot. And, I mean, there is some amount of foolishness and idiocy, but you know, I mean, he's allowed to do what he's doing because a lot of people are permitting it, and I think it is, I think oil, I think military industry, and there's the pro-Israeli factions of what in effect are sort of a coincidence, a confluence of interests between those factors, and also sort of using the, you know, Christian messianic foot soldiers. So I think it's a confluence of those interests that permit this to happen.
Sam Husseini, before we go back to the phone lines, we have a few callers very patiently waiting. I do want to wrap up this point about the coverage of the Iraq War. I mean, before the Iraq War, when the administration was pushing the argument that there were weapons of mass destruction that were imminently poised to attack us, which was the only legal justification for an invasion and overthrow of the Iraqi government, IPA was working directly on this issue for a long time, if I'm not mistaken, with Scott Ritter at times.
Yeah.
And Scott Ritter, of course, is the weapons inspector who said that this was a bogus claim. And Scott Ritter underwent a character assassination campaign that's almost unprecedented in recent years prior to the invasion, such that he was basically blackballed from any sort of news coverage, despite the good efforts of IPA. Is that a fair assessment?
That is a fair assessment.
And now he's been proven entirely accurate, he said.
Yeah, and it's as if the facts don't matter, because, I mean, you'd think that everybody would now go back to him. And not only him, I mean, he was the biggest name. But we put out a lot of people, Susan Wright, Rahul Mahajan, John Burroughs of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. I could list a dozen people who we put out there who were pointing to deceits by the Bush administration. We, in real time, debunked Bush's speeches building up to the war, which, again, we've kept all of that on our webpage. And Scott Ritter was the biggest name, and as you say, he was vilified. Actually, it's kind of funny because we also did a fair amount of work with Cindy Sheehan, both prior to her going to Crawford, and then we actually put out the first news release about what she was going to do in Crawford. And those, I guess, in terms of personalities, and we've tried to have a network of analysts rather than one or two personalities, but those are the two personalities that really the big time, you can say, that we've worked with, and they've both been incredibly, you know, vilified and, you know, mocked and demonized, even though, you know, they're in the case of Scott Ritter, objectively, what he was saying was correct.
And based on the hardest possible evidence that one could have and experience.
Right, based on the hardest possible evidence. I mean, he was going a step beyond. He was saying Iraq has, you know, is qualitatively disarmed. That was always his refrain. Mm. Now, I didn't know that. We relied on him to say that. But what I did know was that Bush was lying, that the evidence that Bush was presenting was full of holes, and we repeatedly harped on that. We repeatedly made that point.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Sam Husseini, you're listening to the communications director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a group based, his office is based in the National Press Building in Washington, where they provide resources for journalists to do better work covering the most important stories of the day. You can learn all about the group at accuracy.org. We have several callers very patiently waiting to get on the air with you, Sam Husseini. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Sam Husseini.
Yeah, good afternoon. I appreciate your having him today. I would like to kind of get back to the whole Christian thing and the mention of the Christian peacemaker teams. I'm very interested in that. I'm a Mennonite, attend the Mennonite church here in town, and a lot of those people who are involved in that organization are Mennonite. I'm just wondering, since you're familiar with the media out there, what the Christian, the more fundamentalist Bush-supporting Christian media has to say about something like what's happening to these people who are quote-unquote Christian as well. And because I've read about them in things like Sojourners and Catholic Worker House, which are more left-leaning.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you could comment on that a little bit, and the whole Christian media thing that you probably have to deal with pretty often these days, and how that's grown. I guess I have a lot of questions.
Well, that's quick, and thank you very much, caller. And Sam, after you're done with that, I've got an add-on for you. Talk a little bit about the independent press, the liberal, left, progressive media especially, and how they've been covering some of these issues. What your take is on that as a resource?
Well, the caller raises a very interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. I haven't been monitoring the quote-unquote right-wing Christian media since the Christian Peacemaker team, but I think that it is a fascinating question and something. We do send our material, our news releases, by email and fax, to a whole plethora of media outlets, including Christian media, right-wing Christian media. So we by no means write them off, and we try to engage them in that fashion. But I think that it's a real issue, and I would really encourage people as activists to be challenging them on that. You know, there's this bizarre world where Christian, you know, means are public, and frankly, these people, Nietzsche said, you know, God is dead because ostensibly, I guess, because nobody believes in him. Well, folks like the Christian Peacemaker team, also Kathy Kelly and Voices in the Wilderness, and a lot of work that they did in trying to break the sanctions on Iraq before the war. Did these, you know, incredibly gutsy actions that really belie, you know, that has a deep resonance, or you'd think it would have a deep resonance with Christian religious folks here in the United States. I think that that's probably why this story isn't getting a lot of pickup, because it would tap into that a religious sentiment in a way that doesn't. Put down gays or focus on issues that the Christian right likes to focus on.
And I would imagine, Sam, that the White House and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld are not holding press conferences every day to update the journalist on this story. They're basically saying nothing, so hoping the story dies.
Hoping that the story dies, and if the Christian Peacemaker team dies, I think the subtext of the story will be, well, you see, you can't act that way or else you'll get killed. Stop trying to engage the Iraqi people directly. Leave it up to us, and sort of a cutting off of direct people-to-people contact, which is what this is an attempt, rather heroic attempt, at doing. Someone would expect Rumsfeld to act that way, but what about the ostensibly Christian groups? Whether it's Focus on the Family or Christian broadcasters and so on, shouldn't they be concerned about that? I think it's the caller's concern, and I think she's absolutely right to raise it. I haven't monitored the right-wing Christian media to give her an answer.
Now, before we get back to our other patient caller, Sam Husseini, let's talk a little bit about the progressive and liberal media, the independent media, the blogosphere, the sort of alternative voices that are out there for people who want to find takes on the world different from that coming from the dominant commercial and public broadcasting news media. What's your assessment of where they're at today and how they're covering the stories you're concerned about at IPA?
I think that they provide very, very good material sometimes, and I get a lot of leads and tips in terms of what I want to do from what they do. Particularly, Democracy Now. I wish I could listen to more, independent media. In addition to that, there are a lot of sharp blogs that I enjoy looking at, and so on. But what I'm struck by, and what is the broad failure of what's happened, particularly being here in D.C., I'm struck by the fact that. If you go to the Independent Press Association, there are God knows how many independent journals out there. You have Pacifica, you got The Nation, you got The Progressive, and so on and so forth. But very little attempt is made to get those institutions to have people in Washington, D.C., for example, going to the news conferences day in, day out. Imagine if, you know, the Nation and the Progressive and some independent bloggers and Democracy Now! And so on had journalists every day asking tough questions at the White House, at the Pentagon, at the Justice Department, at the State Department. I think that that would have a real substantial impact. It would obviously take some resources, but I think it would also, draw people into those media outlets. It would provide for free advertising because you'd end up and say, "Hi, I'm so and so from this media outlet," and you know, in real time, asking the tough question of those governmental officials. I think that there's a wealth to be done here. And I've been sort of startled at the reluctance of alternative or independent media to take on that task.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Sam Husseini, the communications director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's based in the National Press Building in Washington. We've been talking with him this hour about the work of the IPA. You can learn about them at accuracy.org. In essence, they work on the major news stories of the day, trying to insert progressive experts, experts who are outside the mainstream Rolodex or outside the Rolodex, increasingly dominated by corporate-funded conservative think tanks like the Heritage Foundation or the American Enterprise Institute, on crucial issues like Social Security reform, Medicare reform, war and peace issues, environmental issues. It's a pleasure to have Sam Husseini with us today. We have a couple of callers who have been very patient. There is time for other callers indeed. Call this number, 333-9455, or the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455, and we will get to you. Let's go back to the lines now. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with Sam Husseini.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. I've enjoyed the conversation very much. I hope that I have the right context for a question about history. I was in a movie last night which details the Edward R. Murrow, Fred-friendly CBS treatment of the McCarthy era. Good Night and Good Luck, I think, is the name of it. And I was impressed that it sort of showed journalists trying to pursue the truth of the day. And I know that from the context of what you said today that this is very much what your organization tries to do. How would you put what you do today in some historical context with some of the better work that's been done by your forebears in journalism? Thank you, and I will hang up and listen.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Sam, have you ever thought about what you're doing in historical context? First of all, have you seen that movie he's referring to?
I have seen the movie, and I enjoyed it. It's always hard for me to judge things based on historical, because I think you, Bob, might be in a better position to answer this in terms of historical parallels, because I don't, other than my lifetime, I don't know how many myths there are in terms of what is actually going on. I see myths developing all the time based on the conventional wisdom now. I mentioned one earlier that I think it's a myth to say that we now know Bush lied. That's a myth, and it frankly is a liberal myth, because I think it lets a lot of people off the hook for not having challenged Bush before the war. I don't know to what extent it was very moving to see the Edward R. Murrow movie, but I don't know to what extent there are myths in there that I'm not aware of. So it's difficult for me. It's good for me, and I think for all of us, to see things like that to get inspiration from. But I don't know how to assess it historically based on because I didn't live through that era, and I don't know what is being left in and what's being left out of the story.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines then. The number here again, 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple callers patiently waiting. Line 1, Farina, you're on the air with Sam Husseini.
Oh, hi, Bob, a great show again. And Sam, I would really like to hear your thoughts on a couple of things. Myths aside, we the people do have proof of lies. And I'm wondering, because I've seen Scooter Libby has been indicted for lying to the public, I'm wondering if these all can't be prosecuted, and your thoughts on that. And then the other thing is, in regards to oil and the war, is that we get something like, what, 15% of our oil from the Middle East and China, 80% of theirs, and I've yet to hear someone make the connection that aren't we more trying to keep oil away from China than get it? And also, another purpose of this war to me appears to be to put so much against us in the Muslim world as to actually get us in an overt war to be in the near future with the complete military takeover, et cetera, et cetera. Thanks a lot for the show.
Well,
thank you very much.
What's her first point?
Well, I think if I can say the two things that original that she wants you to get at. One is sort of the Scooter Libby, Judith
right.
Miller incident, which I know you've been following very closely at IPA. And maybe you should just tee off on that one for a second.
Yeah, yeah. First off, one of our news releases on the whole Scooter Libby matter when it was developing, we had, and here's a historical parallel, it sort of alludes to the previous questioner as well. We had Bob Perry on a news release, who's a very interesting guy. He now runs a thing called Consortium News, and he was actually at Newsweek and the AP and did a lot of work in breaking the original Iran-Contra story in the 1980s. Bob's take, paralleling the Iran-Contra scandal, was that they're setting up, in all likelihood, by his assessment, what happened with Iran-Contra, which was a Christmas Eve pardon for, you know, they pardoned Weinberger, Bush the First, pardoned Weinberger, Poindexter, and Elliot Abrams, who is in this administration again, as well, I should say, pardoned them, and therefore everybody basically got off on Iran-Contra. And are we setting up a situation like that now, where Scooter Libby basically takes the fall for Cheney, and as his reward is pardoned at some point in the remaining years of this Bush administration? And I think that that's a serious issue. And, you know, there should be substantial pressure made to scrutinize that and to shame them out of that, if possible.
Now,
given that that's a way to bottle up the truth, because now, if that's going to happen, then there's Scooter Libby's under no pressure to come clean.
Sam Husseini, the other part of the question was about the U.S. Role in the Middle East, how it's perceived by people in the Middle East. And we don't have much time left, and I've got a couple of callers I want to get to. So I want to change that a little bit, because before working for the Institute for Public Accuracy, you were media director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. And this was before 9/11.
Right.
What is it like for Arab Americans in the United States today, or Muslim Americans more broadly? And I know not all Arab Americans are Muslim either.
Right.
But what is it like today? And, you know, what is the media role in all this?
I think that it's certainly gotten worse since 9/11. There were substantial problems before, in part because of a lot of political coverage, a lot of, you know, movies that depicted Arabs and Muslims in very negative light, and so on. It's not the focus of my work anymore, but I think that it has made life more difficult for them. But it has also caused, I think, a substantial silence in terms of Arab and Muslim Americans that you know will tolerate you. I feel the broader culture telling them you'll tolerate you so long as you keep your mouth closed politically. And I think, or at least I think that's a wide perception among Arab and Muslim Americans, and therefore they sort of bow out of the political process.
Well, Sam, we've got a lot of people who want to talk to you, and we don't have much time, so
okay.
I'm going to cut so we can go right to the lines, if that's okay. Line 4, Charleston, you're on the air with Sam Husseini. If you could make it brief, that'd be great.
Yeah, I just wondered if you could have a few more details on this sort of assassination of Scott Ritter. In April of 20 of 2002, he came to Urbana and spoke at the Y in one of the most stirringly patriotic presentations I've ever heard, and then he just vanished.
All right, well, thank you, Paula. Yeah, go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, I mean, he's been ignored at this point. There was a lot of stuff about him taking money from Iraqis. I don't want to disseminate.
No, you don't want to dignify it, yeah.
So, but there was a lot of dirt put out on him at crucial times.
That's right.
Okay.
Let's go back to the phone lines again for another patient caller. Line one on the cell phone, you're on the air with Sam Husseini, communications director of the Institute for Public Accuracy.
Oh, thank you. The question is about, back to talk about the think tanks, is there a relationship between the reduced amount of real investigative journalism that big media corporations are doing and the kind of information, the amount of information that they're getting from think tanks? So I guess my question is the information that big media corporations are getting, is investigative journalism being replaced by information from these think tanks?
Thank you. I think that caller needs to get a new cell phone company based on that call. Sam Husseini, investigative journalism, by most accounts, has been plummeting, or at least declining, and these think tanks seem to be playing a larger role. Is that accurate, and if so, is there a relationship?
I think there probably is a relationship, because then you can cite a study put out by Group X rather than having to do your own work. And because of the economic disparities, that's going to further skew things. I mean, there are some think tanks, Center for Public Integrity, for example, that does some hard-hitting work that used to be done by media companies themselves. But that's on the decline, and therefore I think that's an interesting observation, that think tanks, therefore, fill in that void.
Sam Husseini, we've only got a couple minutes left, and I do want you to go back to the work of the Institute for Public Accuracy. We've talked a lot about the work in Iraq that you've been doing on the Iraq story. Is there anything else or any other aspects of that story that that you're working on that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, I did, I should say, one of the callers mentioned Judy Miller. She was at the press club a couple of weeks ago, and I had a run-in with her, where I basically challenged her to disclose some of the sources.
And this is after she's resigned?
After she's resigned. Just after she resigned, she had a one-on-one with Marvin Kalb, who's incredibly deferential to her. It was quite sickening. And I cited some of her stories and cited, this source obviously lied to you. This source claimed that the scientists, the nuclear scientists at Oak Ridge were saying that that the nuclear tubes that Saddam Hussein was trying to get were compatible with getting nuclear weapons. In fact, the scientists at Oak Ridge were saying the exact opposite. Who was that source that used you as a conveyor belt for lies? And she declined to say who that source was. So what you see there is a continuation of Judy Miller and the New York Times having this allegiance to their sources that propelled war, and they were very willing accomplices in that rather than a dedication to their readers. And I think that we need to really think about journalism in terms of what we need from media outlets. And I think that there's a hunger, if we can come up with it, between the blogs and the independent media and so on, towards creating something different that actually serves readers and that some way gets readers also to communicate with each other and globally. I think that the pieces are there. We just haven't managed to find a way to make them fit together.
Well, Sam Husseini, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which usually means it's time for me to clear out of the studio and let Tavis Smiley move in. Our guest today on Media Matters has been Sam Husseini, communications director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's based in the National Press Building in Washington, D.C. You can learn all about the work of the Institute for Public Accuracy at the website accuracy.org. Sam Husseini also has his own website, husseini.org. Sam, have you ever seen the film Tell the Truth and Run, the documentary about George Saldes?
Back when it came out quite a while ago.
Yeah, it was nominated in 1996 for the Oscar for Best Documentary. One of our listeners sent an email in or called in and recommended that anyone interested in what you've been talking about today ought to see that film, Tell the Truth and Run, the story of George Saldes, the legendary great journalist through much of the 20th century. Sam, thanks so much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure having you. My name is Bob McChesney. I'm your host here. You've been listening to Media Matters, and we'll be back 1 week from today. And I want to thank Brett, and I want to thank Andrew, engineer and producers extraordinaire. See you in a week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a chance of flurries. The high in the upper 30s with west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with light snow likely in the evening, then patchy light freezing drizzle after midnight, accumulation up to an inch. The low around 20 degrees with southeast winds around 10 miles per hour this evening, becoming light. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 20s and light winds. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.